Good morning and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We are an independent association of students of the philosophy of theosophy. The basis for the unity of all those who attend and participate is a similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching. That aim is the understanding and the realization of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy in order that we can make ourselves better able to help and teach others. Because the Lodge regards as theosophists all those who are engaged in the true service of humanity, regardless of their race, creed, condition, or organization. And the purpose of this study and promulgation goes even deeper, because part of making ourselves better able to help and teach others is gaining a truer realization of the self and a profounder conviction that universal brotherhood is a fact in nature. So this is the basis of our unity. There are no constitution, bylaws, officers. All the work here is done on a voluntary basis, contribution of time, service, and money. So the program here in Philadelphia, in line with this policy, this declaration that unites ULT wherever it may be found around the world, consists of two weekly meetings. On Wednesday evening, we have a study class in the Ocean of Theosophy. That meeting starts at 7:30 promptly and ends at 8:30. We are in the beginning of the study of the idea of reincarnation. And for this Wednesday evening, we are taking up the idea of what is it that reincarnates. On Sunday mornings, throughout the winter, we have a more formal presentation of the philosophy of theosophy, either in the format of a lecture or a panel, such as what we will have this morning, or a forum, which is basically a shorter talk with more time for questions and answers. The morning program on Sunday begins at 11 and ends at 12 noon. The doors open at 10:30. The overall arching umbrella theme for the month of January is the path of spiritual evolution. And next week we will be looking at the idea of taking up responsibility for our development. And today our subject, keeping in line with this theme for January, is realization of spiritual identity and unity. Now, in addition to these programs, we have a library. It is a reference library available for your independent research. It's open on Wednesdays from 5:15 to 7:15. There's a volunteer there, a student, that can help you find what information you're interested in learning about related to theosophy. You also find the part assigned there and the reference material for that Wednesday evening class available. And it is strongly encouraged that in addition to this collective and group effort, we take some individual time to explore these ideas and check, test, and verify them for ourselves. So we have a book table available on the first floor here The book table is open before and after meetings and during library hours. On there, you can find books, pamphlets, magazines, photographic reproductions of the original writings of H.P.B. and William Q. Judge. These printed materials are available at the cost of shipping and production. There is no profit made by the lodge from the sale of the books. As a matter of fact, these same materials are available free, of course, at the library, and on most of them are available free on the various ULT websites. If you would like to know the web addresses for those sites, you can inquire at the student volunteer at the book table. As we mentioned, everything here is done on a voluntary basis of time, service, and money. All are welcome to attend, and any effort made is greatly appreciated and beneficial for all. This morning, then, we are going to have a panel presentation of this idea of spiritual identity and spiritual unity, realizing it. A panel basically is two short presentations, leaving time for questions and discussion. So, as mentioned, our overall theme for this month is the path of spiritual knowledge. And one of the ideas, basic ideas, we get from the philosophy is for human evolution, it requires our self-induced and self-devised effort, especially when it comes to spiritual evolution as well as our intellectual and mental evolution. So the idea is that there's going to be some search and effort required to reach the goal. And the goal here is that of spiritual evolution. Now, in beginning any path, it's good to have a guide or a map, a manual. And for 5,000 years now, one of the best manuals on that we find in the Bhagavad Gita. Of course, there are many devotional books, but we're going to begin our search for truth regarding this subject with the teaching of Krishna, who lived and taught 5,000 years ago. I'm going to open with a few words of his from chapter 9 to set the tone. Unto thee who findeth no fault, I will now make known this most mysterious knowledge, coupled with a realization of it, which having known, thou shalt be delivered from evil. This is the royal knowledge, the royal mystery, the most excellent purifier, clearly comprehensible, not opposed to sacred law, easy to perform, and inexhaustible. So it's clear from what is said here by Krishna that such knowledge as he is going to present is prerequisite to the journey on the path of spiritual knowledge. But there are two aspects. First, we have to have the knowledge, understand its meaning, at least from an intellectual point of view, and then we need to realize it, make it part of our own everyday wisdom. So the first panel presentation this morning, we'll look at it from the perspective of understanding the meaning of what we mean by spiritual identity and spiritual unity. And then the second panelist will look at how do we realize it practically and make it part of our own wisdom. So a good place to begin, of course, is with definitions, the understanding of words, because their words are so powerful, and we often find that words can sometimes also be inadequate in understanding spiritual truths, but they're a good place to start. So we all understand that the idea of identity means basically how things are the same, how they're alike, their similarities. And gosh, there's so many bases by which we classify or understand things to be identical. In the physical world, the kingdoms, the beings in the different kingdoms of nature can have similar physical properties and qualities, and we certainly can see similarities in of behavior. We say people speak alike, or they think alike, or they feel alike, or they're identical in their upbringing, or they have an identical origin, their heredity, or their family influence or cultural influence makes them identical in a certain way. So there's so many different bases by which we understand things to be identical. But identity is different than unity. Unity is more the idea of how the uniting of things, the connection of various parts into one cooperative whole. That's what unity is. And once again, we have many different bases for unity. When people get together and try to be unified or cooperate, we can have laws, a constitution, we can have a rulers, we can have presidents, we have different creeds that people follow, different methods, all sorts of ways by which people are unified. And they can, of course, as we said at the beginning, be unified on the basis of their common aim, purpose, and teaching. But spiritual unity and spiritual identity are different. And that's because even at our very basic understanding of spirit and spiritual, we know we're referring to something that's non-physical, essential, vital, and shared by all. A common basis for all. So whereas the definition helps us get started, it proves to be inadequate because all our understanding of unity and similarity and identity is different, is partial. People identify and are unity, they consider themselves one, but it's only in one characteristic. It doesn't have a common underlying thread or bond that unites all beings. And so we need to go further to search for this non-physical vital essence, this spiritual essence that is the same in all, the source of all, and connects all. And so if we were to continue to read, we won't, but if we were to continue to read in chapter 9 of the Bhagavad Gita, we would see that Krishna talks about spirit in the sense that it's invisible, all pervasive, the source of all, containing all. And he resorts to that metaphor, that analogy that we use here in Theosophy as well, that of the idea of space, that which contains all and pervades all. And space gives us some concept of that underlying fundamental essence and unity. But he also goes on to point in one of the earlier chapters, chapter 2, that in order to really understand spirit or the spiritual essence at all, we have to know it within ourselves. And so he points to the spiritual part of human nature, that part in us which is indestructible, eternal, and universal. So the teachings of Krishna are, of course, very helpful. we're going to add to them the light of some of the theosophical principles to further help us understand and realize spiritual unity. So theosophy speaks of a first fundamental deific principle, that which is boundless, eternal, changeless, in everything, pervades everything, the one source of all. We can call it the deific principle if we wish, and we can give it any name we wish that represents that high idea in our mind. But if we use the term God, we want to be careful that we don't bring to it an anthropomorphic idea of a big person or some being separate from ourselves and separate from the universe. Because this idea of deity is not limited by any human conception. As a matter of fact, it has no limits. It's absolute. It has no qualities. It transcends any kind of finite human understanding. And yet, since it is all pervasive, an aspect or a spark or a ray, if you wish, of this deific essence, it can be found within each and every being. Now, the human being is uniquely capable of self-analyzing reflection and recognizing within oneself this deific essence and uniting oneself consciously with it and making it a practical basis for their action and their thinking and their speaking in relating to other people and beings. And so this ultimate divine essence in each being, in each human being, we might call the higher self. The higher self is universal, it's absolute, it doesn't have any qualities, and it is permanent. Now, we understand what our personal self is because that part of us we identify with certain conditions. And those conditions change throughout life, and they change from person to person. At one point, we think of our personal selves as having a certain physical nature, a height, a weight, a physical appearance, having a certain mood or certain understanding or a certain pattern of behavior. But that can change, and it differs from others. The higher self, or what is sometimes called the individual self, we recognize as that unchanging sense of identity. It wells up in our mental awareness as an awareness of I am, and that awareness of I, or essential identity, does not change throughout all the days and years of our lives, does not change throughout all the experiences we have, whether they are pleasurable or unpleasurable, favorable or adverse, good or bad, indifferent. It's the same I experiencing, witnessing those changes. And that I is not only continuous and changeless, but each human being can identify within their nature that sense of I. So it gives us a sense of spiritual identity, our oneness, the common bond, the likeness between all of us on that spiritual plane. The apparent differences between beings and human beings are temporary, but the real basis, the real nature of a being is one and the same in each and all. And then if we move to the idea of spiritual unity, theosophy helps us understand this from a way, if there is this underlying spiritual identity, then spiritual unity we can recognize as the interdependence and interrelationship on every plane of being because of that oneness. And so the laws of karma, action and reaction, the constant harmony and balance in the universe that needs to be restored, all show that we do not act alone. As we act, we not only affect ourselves, but we affect others, and others certainly interact and affect us. We cannot escape from this interdependence and unity on every plane of being. So this is a process of learning, and although we can get an inkling of the path and begin the path, because nature is so varied and so immense in its possibility, we cannot gain the whole picture in any one life. And so we might say that it is the goal, the purpose of evolution, particularly human evolution, where we develop self-consciousness and independent free will and choice, to continuously search to find that spiritual unity, that God or deific consciousness within ourselves. And so this path of realizing it in our everyday lives, as well over many lives, is what our next presenter will take up.
It would be wonderful if we could just walk around at all times with all we just heard. But even if we did that, it would still only be intellectual. The ideas we heard are alive, but unless we're alive to them, they're just ideas. So we have to go beyond the intellect. And how do we do that? Well, we think one of the easiest examples to show why it is difficult for us to do that is to consider learning something new, whatever it is. And the best example may be riding a bike. You can read everything ever written about bicycles. You could even learn to take a bike apart and put it back together, as long as it didn't have more than 3 gears. And then you still wouldn't know anything about riding a bike. All you know is about a bicycle, not you and that bicycle interacting. And the minute one tries it, one learns what they don't know about balance, what they never thought of in regards to conquering a simple thing like a bicycle. And yet, once we do it, we never forget it. It's always said, you can always ride a bike no matter how old you are. Once you have learned that balance, it becomes part of you. Well, in the same way, once we learn balance on the idea of our own spiritual identity, then we can't ever lose it. We may not honor it or live up to it, but we can't unknow it. We think one of the best ways to consider I am I and I never change is to stop and realize all the changes you have been through, physical, mental, emotional. You are a very different person, and yet you're still I. One who is even subject to some strange disease and wakes up with amnesia, what's the first thing they ask? Who am I? They know I am I, but I don't know how to identify it. So once we pursue the realization of that sense of identity that is changeless, then we are into a new territory, a spiritual territory. How do we use that realization of our own identity into unity with all that lives? Especially in our world, which is fiercely competitive, from the time we are small children, it's like, I am I, and I have to take care of me because you won't. And I have to work very hard to compete with you to get the things that I need. And these are all false ideas. But because we don't rely on the spiritual ideas, we are trapped for the moment. So how do we get out of it? Well, one of the ways we're told is to start paying attention. Not change, but pay attention. Take a week or 2 weeks or a month and just watch yourself in action. What are my intentions? How do I feel when I do something and someone reacts the way I would not want them to? They don't appreciate me or thank me. Just observe, learn, these are my motives. My motives are not to be brotherly. My motives are perhaps to be admired or appreciated. How do we then begin to change those motives? Only by constantly, like a scientist, recording, observing what it is about ourselves until we see what we need to change. Having seen that, we have to understand how are we going to replace that? How are we going to change our actions that show we are all one? Well, some will think from this moment on, I will start acting for and as the self of all. But that won't do, because that's hard to remember when somebody cuts you off on the highway, when you are being rudely treated by someone. We lose that sense of wholeness, of unity. So we have to take a position inside ourselves that says, how do I act? How do I feel? How can I accept and understand and be forgiving of how another acts, and it seemingly against me? So we stand in a strange position of balance. We know we are spiritual. We know the others are spiritual, but we are all acting on the basis of the personal. So we ourselves have to stand above that so that we see what we're doing and we learn why we're doing it. And as you learn why, you are then capable of changing. Now, there are many methods that one can use to retreat to a higher, quieter place in order to make these observations. There's meditation, of course, but one isn't always able to meditate at a given moment. So there were some, you know, simpler things to use. For some people, it might be music. Turn on a piece of music and it will calm them and settle them. For another, it might be a painting or a picture. For some, it's quotes. And the nice thing about quotes is you can carry them around with you and take them medicinally as you need them. We have been collecting quotes for so many years. It just says we need more help than most, right? De Chardin said, we are not human beings having a spiritual experience. We are spiritual beings having a human experience. Now, if you carry that quote around you with you for a day, every incident that you're in that arouses something negative in you, you think of that. Wait a minute. This is a human experience I'm having, but I'm not a human. I'm a spiritual being within that human experience. You have to grow from the inside out. None can teach you, none can make you spiritual. There is no other teacher but your own soul. Vivekananda said that. By the way, these quotes I'm reading from now are from a collection of Theosophical Independence, which was a newsletter that we here at the Lodge did for 10 years, and they're quite wonderful, speaking modestly. Here is the test to find whether your mission on Earth is finished. If you're alive, it isn't. Richard Bach. Now, take that and use that for a week. whatever happens to you, oh, this experience is for your learning. That's why you're alive. Only in the human form is it possible for life to attain its final goal, which is to realize the all-pervading and infinite divinity, Meher Baba. The final goal to realize the all-pervading and infinite divinity. I am that. All other life is that. Even the life in this table is that. We have to start treating life with more respect. And a quote, some quotes that are mysterious, that you carry them with you, they not shock you, but provoke you. Rabindranath Tagore said, "The one who plants trees, knowing that he will never sit in their shade, has at least started to understand the meaning of life." If any of you are fans of Central Park, we've forgotten his name, the gentleman who designed it, and we think Central Park was, they just went around and changed a few things. No, they built it. They made those mounds and those hills and built it with a special design in mind and planted those trees. He did that design. He did all that work, knowing he would never live to see it, because it would take 50, 60 years just to begin. So we have to have that kind of attitude. As was said, it can't happen in one life. We go from the intellectual understanding of what is spiritual to an understanding of who and what we are, what is our duty towards life, and that takes lives. Or as the Indian said, it's a good thing there's reincarnation. It takes 12 lifetimes to learn to play the sitar. Well, we have many more other quotes. Mark Twain's, "The more I see of people, the more I love my dogs." But we can learn to love life and the need for unity. And we see it right now on our earth. There are people banding together for a higher purpose than a personal one. And that's what we need to do, but we need to do it within ourselves with intelligence and using the right tools, whether they're quotes from wiser people, poets, philosophers, or what most of us prefer and need. And that's the study of the teaching of those great souls, the Mahatmas who brought theosophy back to the world in this cycle in 1875. So we need to study, we need to learn, we need to practice, but above all, even if we fail at that and can't even handle the vocabulary, we need to at least know, I am a spiritual being, and I am one with all that lives. Now, your questions. You're going to call on people.
Yes.
We were wondering, will there always be those who know to be around to let it be known to those who don't know?
You're asking a question that relates to everything we know about humanity. Will children always have parents? Yes, or they couldn't be children. There will always be those who know and who want to give it and share it with those who don't. And you can look back in history at the what we call great theosophists who have spoken, usually not written. Written has only been in this last cycle. And we have their words, the Buddha. So the answer is yes, there will always be. And if we get to the point where we are knowing, then we will be the helpers in the next cycle.
So the question arises from that, if there always are those great souls that know and try to help humanity, can I contact them? Are they there to help me individually? And if we go back to that idea of evolution and interdependence, yes, it's one of individual self-induced and self-devised effort. But for any of us who has tried to make themselves better, we know we can't just do it alone. We need some assistance. And even if we learn from the mistakes and failures of others, that's a help. At least we know what not to do. And so as we make effort on this path, we come in contact with those like ourselves, other searchers, companions on the path. They may not be great souls. They don't have to be. But they may touch us in a way. They may give us an idea, an experience, an insight that we needed in the moment. It's, of course, coming to us under karma. We've planted seeds for the help of others, maybe those very individuals in the past, and now we're helped in turn. So there are always those who know, but then everyone around us is a teacher and knows. Even our enemies can teach us things we would not otherwise have known.
And in a way, especially our adversaries.
Adversaries.
Yes.
Yes.
Realization of spiritual identity and unity. We've heard the term during this talk a couple of times, spiritual evolution. And, you know, on the one hand, we recognize spirit as a principle in nature. Can we investigate what we really mean by one's spiritual evolution?
Okay. So we'll first take that from the intellectual point of view. So what does it mean to evolve spiritually? Well, that's actually the subject of this entire month, so we're going to look at that from all different perspectives. But first of all, it's identifying the part in us that is spiritual, enduring. And with this, we have the idea that we have a personality that is relative, temporary, impermanent. It has its beginning and it will have its end. But there is also that part in us, in addition to that identity, that sense of I, which is spiritual and enduring. That is ourselves as thinkers, observers, or experiencers. And whatever we experience, we have been through throughout our lives, all our experience teaches us that we are a spiritual being, the same spiritual being, the thinker, the observer, the experiencer, going through various human experiences and gaining wisdom and character from that experience. So part of spiritual evolution is the continual evolution, development from life to life of spiritual knowledge and wisdom assimilated to our nature. The example was given of riding a bike. Once we learn a spiritual truth and make it part of our being, it becomes part of our permanent nature, and we bring it back as character, as insight, as inherent wisdom, as a drive, a search for knowledge, whatever it may come through as. The other part of spiritual evolution is learning to help this instrument we use be a better vehicle. So if we were saying, how do we become a better musician? Well, we have to be a better artist, but we also need the proper instrument or violin or piano or learn how to use the instrument so all our knowledge and skill can be applied. So both those aspects are involved in spiritual evolution. Okay, over here on the left.
I think the panel is set up well to investigate these seemingly opposing perspectives, one of them being the path and the fruit or the realization, and one being the personality and the being itself. And I think the question is, how are the two interrelated, and then how can we not only meditate but use the personality as a mirror of sorts, or as a magnifying glass to potentially reveal places where I'm experiencing aversion or challenge, struggle. And it's possible, it seems, that through the attention process, that the aversions, the I don't want or the I don't like, reveals the, let's say, an incomplete, so to speak, quadrant of the spiritual being that is seeking to express itself and expand in all directions.
Well, what you're asking is a subject we just covered in The Ocean of Theosophy. And if you have a computer, you can go online and you can read all of the main theosophical texts. It is the mind, which is a being. We're mind beings, we're thinkers, but it's also a principle that we use. And as an individual with a higher perspective, we use what we call the higher mind, which is non-separating, which is inclusive and altruistic and compassionate. Or else, when we have an aversion or an attraction, we use the lower personal mind to get what we want, no matter what anybody else thinks or feels. So that mirror is the mind, and it is that we try to clean and keep as clean as we can. In other words, we are judging ourselves, not judging others.
Your question reminded us directly of a quote from The Voice of the Silence, where it says, "The mind is like a mirror. It gathers dust while it reflects. It needs the gentle breezes of soul wisdom to brush away the dust of our illusions." Summary of the presentation this morning in a few lines, but it was mentioned by the presenter that the first thing we need to do is recognize that there is dust on the mirror. You know, we go through life and our glasses are dirty, our headlights are dirty, our windshield's dirty, and that's life. We're supposed to go through life with dirty mirrors, dirty glasses, and dirty. And somebody says, "Well, hey, why don't you clean them off?" Aha! Go to the car wash, clean your glasses, brush off the mirror, and you see things that you didn't see before. But in order to do the cleaning, you need the cleaning material. And this is where ideas can help. Because what clouds our inner mirror, what is the dust on our inner mirror, are ideas.
One quick thing. Most songs are so, I don't know, fictionalized or romanticized. But there is a song about this problem that's truthful. I can see clearly now. I can see all obstacles in my way. That is a very theosophical statement. Okay. It isn't to escape from our problems, but to see them clearly so we can clean them up and fix them.
And it is a song of hope. It doesn't say if I've overcome all my obstacles. It just says, I can see clearly now. I see all the obstacles. And within that, there's the understanding that now that I can see them, I have the power to overcome them. Because the same power is spiritual. The power to see, the power to recognize, the power to be aware is from spirit, and the power to move, the power to change is from spirit. The power to know is from spirit. There's no separate. It's the same power used in a variety of ways.
And we forgot to bring up that particular point. In any situation, even if it is a horribly difficult, unpleasant situation, you can hold in your mind at the same time you are facing this, that individual soul is using the very same powers I'm using. They see things differently. That's their right. I have no right to judge them in that. And if I can't offer a seed to help, just let it happen. Epictetus taught that if someone criticizes you and you feel like laughing, it has nothing to do with you. If someone criticizes you and you feel like defending yourself, take a moment to appreciate they have just given you gold. Absolute gold that you can go home and mine it and understand it and realize where you have to make some changes. And that's the adversary position. And we can be grateful for our adversaries because they educate us about our obstacles.
You had your hand up before.
Well, we were thinking in terms of, all of life is alive and intelligent. Conscious, all of it, and we see a natural progression in within nature, that all of life is moving. It's moving, and moving what? Mm-hmm. Toward a higher expression of this consciousness, and it seems that it's all striving to be in this human kingdom, where it is self-conscious. So it seems that we are truly as the gods.
We are truly what?
Are as gods. We can choose, mm-hmm. and we're self-aware. You know, that's no other kingdom can boast of having that responsibility.
Theosophy teaches that as thinkers, we are here on this planet for a dual purpose, to grow in our own awareness and understanding, and that's through the realization that I am the self working in this manner. And the other is that we have a responsibility to the lower kingdoms to elevate and bring up to the highest possible point of awareness, because even breathing, eating, anything and everything we do, we are exchanging life with lower lives. They are influenced by us. In other words, the expression, when the lion lies down with the lamb, that's the way it should be. But our influence on the lower kingdoms has been so negative that they are like safety valves where you see a lot of destruction that wouldn't be there if it weren't for our negative thinking.
Where that is our ultimate purpose, from day to day, very often it's enough to be able to improve our own awareness and to help another human being, let alone all
yeah.
life. But that's the ultimate goal, but we begin where we are. And we're thinking that a physical scientist coming into a laboratory views the instruments and the elements and the forces with respect, with care, but does not say, hydrogen has it in for me today. O2, I just can't get them apart. You know, approaches it with an understanding of a knowledge of the elements and the forces involved and what it takes to get these things to work together and what things should not be done. In other words, impassionately but passionately compassionately approaches the subject. Well, as a spiritual scientist, we do the same. Too often we approach it like the scientist that goes into the laboratory and says, oxygen has it in for me today. In other words, we view other human beings as persons separate from ourselves. Rather, a better way for a spiritual scientist on the path of knowledge and evolution, improvement of oneself and others, is to approach others as oneself, dealing with ideas and forces. What distinguishes human beings is not their essential essential identity, but the ideas they hold and the forces they have at their command because of those ideas. So when you're dealing with another human being, whether it's a pleasant or an unpleasant, especially an unpleasant experience, don't look at it as coming from a person, but rather deal with the ideas that are being expressed and the forces, and observe them from that center, that position of the spiritual being, the changeless experiential being, the thinker, if you will. In the back.
Well, we don't stop to think every day. Someone comes up to us and say, who are you? And you give, the answer you give is called an identification. We never stop to think about the languages we're using, which falls in line with our talk this morning. If we would stop occasionally and pay close attention to the question we received and the answer we give, how would you identify that tete-a-tete back and forth between two individuals? Who are you? I am so-and-so and so.
Are you implying that we should answer from the highest spiritual level we can?
Well, we may not at that point, but if we're together for a length of time, the conversation we hold would be a key.
Well, that's an important point. The other, including ourselves at times, has to be ready to have that conversation. And we know that within the world right now, there seems to be more greed and fear and certain religious dogmas that pull people apart and make people reject other people, not for any logical, sensible reason either. But we have to be cautious. We know when one first starts studying theosophy, your enthusiasm can be so great you drive away all of your friends. Some of them come back because they're hoping you will be quiet now. But it is important that we know who we are. We have an identification, but that's not our identity. And as long as we know that and depend on that and live in that, we do need an identification.
Once again, it's the idea. You're dealing with ideas and forces. Somebody comes to you and says, who are you? What is the idea in the question? What do they mean? Well, they're looking, as we all do, to understand one's personal identity. What kind of human being are you? What's your name? Where do you live? That's the way we interact with each other on this plane. But it's a mask. It's a persona. So let's say an actor goes out on a stage one night and performs a Shakespearean role. Well, for the moment, the better actor will become Othello, or will become Macbeth. Completely different characters, but they get absorbed in the role. They don't forget who and what they are when the show's over. They may observe, they might put on a different mask, their own personal mask, who they are. Or they'll go out with their friends and they put on another mask. But it's the same individuality, the same thinker, the same spiritual being in all those roles. So when people ask who and what we are, they're trying to understand the mask that appears to them, and we can respond in that way. We can use this instrument to answer their question, but at the same time not losing sight of what that we are the actor on the stage, the spiritual being in the midst of this experience.
Well, one of the attitudes that we are told that it's helpful for us to adopt is that of in-person, is an attitude to develop of impersonality. And the philosophy is that. It's impersonal. It's the same for each of us. So is this impersonality a way for us to grow?
Impersonality does not mean cold. Doesn't mean heartless. Doesn't mean without feeling or understanding of the human experience. It means not to treat people as separate personal beings, but as oneself. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The impersonal basis is the universal basis, the basis of oneness and unity. We use the word impersonal to distinguish it from personality, but it's not a negative, it's a positive effort to seek oneness in our communication and our relationship with whomever we are.
And of course, the one fact that we must always keep in mind is this is a universe of law. It's not chance. So the individuals we meet, the personalities we have to deal with, it's of our making. No matter what comes to us, we brought it to ourselves. We have, maybe some of you are already familiar with this. It's by Mother Teresa, and is certainly one of the best poems to keep around. People are often unreasonable and self-centered. Forgive them anyway. If you are kind, people may accuse you of ulterior motives. Be kind anyway. If you are honest, people may cheat you. Be honest anyway. If you find happiness, people may be jealous. Be happy anyway. The good you do today may be forgotten tomorrow. Do good anyway. Give the world the best you have, and it may never be enough. Give your best anyway. For you see, in the end, it is between you and God. It was never between you and them anyway.
One more point?
Just quickly to the idea of impartiality and peace.
Pardon?
Just quickly to the idea of impartiality and peace and compassion. I think it's interesting to note that there's a relationship between peace and, let's say, power. Mm-hmm. That is, both of them, in their absolute, let's say, definition, represent a state that is not disturbed, threatened. It's not imposed upon. So I think that it can sometimes, the idea of peaceful interaction can, on the surface, seem to point to a certain meekness or lying down.
No, it takes more courage to be peaceful than to be strong and rugged. And but we have a strict rule of living by cycles, and the time for our meeting this morning is over. So we should go in peace and know that peace is power, is strength.
Thank you. Our meeting's adjourned.